From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
The resignation of Gladys Berejiklian after the New South Wales Independent Commission Against Corruption announced it was investigating her conduct arising from her relationship with disgraced former MP Darryl Maguire has reignited debate about the proposed Federal Integrity Commission. The Morrison government promises to introduce legislation for that commission before Christmas. But its model, as originally outlined, received scathing criticism for being too weak. So far, we haven't seen the final version following consultations. We do know, however, that it won't be anything like the New South Wales ICAC. Referring to that body, Scott Morrison said this week that it was certainly not a model his government would ever consider. Stephen Charles is a retired judge of the Victorian Court of Appeal and a campaigner for stronger mechanisms for public integrity and accountability. He is a board member of the Centre for Public Integrity, which has just produced a report that's damning about the Morrison government's model for the Integrity Commission. Stephen Charles joins us today. Stephen Charles, let's start with the assertions that we're hearing from some critics, that ICAC was unfair to Gladys Berejiklian for one reason or another, including, for example, the timing of its announcement. Do you believe that ICAC has performed within its proper functions?
Yes, I do. I don't think that it's a matter for ICAC to time its announcements according to what people might think politically desirable. They have to make their own decisions as to whether a matter has reached a point where it's desirable to announce a public hearing. I think they performed their duties perfectly appropriately.
Gladys Berejiklian has quit the premiership and said she'll quit the parliament. But more generally, should politicians facing an integrity commission investigation step down, or is that dependent on the individual case?
I would have thought the latter, that it's a matter for the individual case. That there have been other cases, for example, when Premier O'Farrell got caught up in investigation, his difficulty was that accidentally he committed perjury. He denied on oath that he'd received a bottle of wine. And I think it would have been entirely appropriate for him to have continued on as Premier, to have said it was just a matter of a loss of memory. I now remember it. And of course, yes, I did receive a bottle of wine. And I don't think anyone would have criticised him for a moment. I think it will depend upon whether the politician in question has enough of an idea about what is involved to think that the appropriate course is to step aside or even to resign. I wouldn't have thought that the situation had reached a point where the Premier needed to resign, but I think that from what we've seen, stepping aside would have been the appropriate course at this point.
We're talking here about the Berejiklian case.
Yes.
Now, attention is now on Dan Andrews. It's been reported that the Victorian anti-corruption body is looking at his conduct in relation to deals benefiting the firefighters' union. Should he stand aside?
Again, it depends. The invariable practice with the integrity commissions of which I am aware is that long and detailed private investigations take place before any sort of announcement is made that an investigation is happening or that a public hearing is about to occur. Now, I haven't heard it said yet even that a private hearing is likely to occur about Mr. Andrews. He will have much better information, obviously, than we do. We do not know how far the investigation has gone. So it's a matter for each individual case. I do not know enough about the facts of this case to answer the question, so far as Mr. Andrews is concerned.
Let's turn to the federal scene. Will the Berejiklian matter help or hinder in the argument regarding a federal integrity commission?
To this extent, it will hinder it in that the a number of federal politicians have made remarks about the undesirability of having any sort of public investigation of politicians. It's been described, the ICAC has been described as a sort of Spanish Inquisition.
That was Barnaby Joyce, I think.
That Barnaby Joyce said that, yes, indeed. and others have used it as a means of attacking the ICAC. Chris Merritt in The Australian will undoubtedly use it as a basis for attacking the ICAC, and they will move on from there to saying how undesirable it would be to have a national integrity commission with the power to hold public hearings. I think that, on the other hand, there are plenty of people who, in the public arena, will listen to the arguments and say, well, it is desirable that we have public discussion of these things. We need to know more about the facts of investigations into integrity. I think, on balance, that there may be enough now positive discussion about a National Integrity Commission for it to be positively helpful. The argument for an NIC has been going on for years. Mr. Morrison promised us one in 2018. In recent times, people might have thought that the debate about this matter has all died down. Something of this kind happening involving Ms. Berejiklian has very much started the argument again, and a lot of people will start to think again about a National Integrity Commission, so it will depend on how they react to it, and I would hope they'll be interested and want to think about it.
It's interesting you say the debate has been going on for years, and yet some years ago, neither side of federal politics thought such a body was necessary nationally, did they? They thought that corruption tended to be a state issue. Why do you think that it took so long for a view to be reached that we do need a national body?
Well, in the first place, Australia is a signatory to the United Nations Convention Against Corruption. Article 36 of that convention requires Australia to have an effective body to deal with corruption. And those of us who've been arguing for a national integrity body have been pointing to Australia's failure to comply with its obligations under UNCAC for a long time. Now, the sorts of things that have arisen in recent times, we have seen matters such as the sports rorts and the car park rorts. But going back well before that, you had plenty of examples of what we would call corruption in the federal sphere. And one of the problems is that there is no body really in the federal field which is there to protect us against corruption. Now, the best example of this is procurement. Each year, the Commonwealth spends tens of billions of dollars, if not much more than tens of billions, in procurement and health, defence and education. The best example of procurement. Now, at the moment, there is nobody, no entity in the federal sphere to deal with corruption in procurement. There have been plenty of investigations carried out from time to time, which, for example, in relation to the Defence Department, there was a report in about 2018 in The Age about an audit of procurement, individual actions of procurement, which showed that in relation to a very large number of them, the audit was not able to be completed because of missing paperwork, or alternatively, that it demonstrated that there had been departures from departmental rules. Equally, that same report showed that there were many views in the Defence Department itself that people thought that corruption was present in quite a high degree, particularly with senior public servants being offered very large contracts, very profitable contracts, to leave the department and move out into private industry. So that there have been repeated instances of corruption. Securency, the companies that were involved in printing notepaper for overseas governments, it was notorious that huge sums were being paid to get at contracts with overseas countries, and enormous sums of money were being paid into tax havens. Now, there was an abundance of instances of potential corruption which started people agitating for a body of this kind. A major question has been and always will be donations. Political donations come in particularly, obviously, at election times, but hundreds of millions of dollars are given in political donations to both parties, speaking, that is, of the Coalition and Labour. Now, these political donations are in large part bribes. They are bribes for access and influence, and they are very effective. And when people make a large bribe seeking access and influence, if they do not get a return on those large donations, then the donations won't recur. Most people nowadays believe that political donations should be reformed drastically and largely prevented in relation to donations other than very small donations. At first it was thought it was very difficult to stop political donations being given, but in a number of cases recently in the High Court, it has been held that provided the laws are carefully thought out and fair, they will survive. So nowadays, it is principally the coalition that is resistant to the reform of the law of political donations. Why? Well, the coalition is the largest recipient of them by a large margin.
Well, on a, I guess, a related front too, one could argue that we need reform of the exit arrangements for politicians, couldn't you? Because we have seen a number of politicians go into very lucrative positions that are broadly related to earlier responsibilities they had.
I could not agree more. There should be provisions made in relation to that. We should have much more concern about lobbyists than presently we do. There is a lobbyist register, but most lobbyists, I am told, are not even on the register, so that there are hundreds of people moving around as lobbyists, and with the public having no idea which particular fossil fuel lobby or the like is having ready access to which politicians. Ministers' diaries are not made public.
Let's move to the model that then Attorney General Christian Porter outlined for the National Integrity Commission. Now, this model has been subject to consultations and we don't know how it's been changed, what the legislation will look like that the government says it will introduce before the end of the year. But going back to that original model, it was very narrow. And for example, you mentioned the sports rorts and car park program. They wouldn't have come under it, would they?
No, that they would not. It's a very odd arrangement which was offered by Mr. Porter's model. His model was first proposed in late 2018 in a memorandum which was put out, and the exposure draft, which was published something like a year ago, made very little substantial change from that first model. And that was at the time when both the Prime Minister and Mr. Porter were saying that they would introduce legislation for a Commonwealth Integrity Commission. There are two halves to this body. Half of it deals with law enforcement personnel right up to the top, and the other half deals with the rest of the public service. Now, the oddity is that the half that deals with law enforcement personnel is very strong. The definition of corruption is broad. The definition concludes or corruption of any other kind. Now, anyone may make a complaint to the Criminal Investigation Commission, CIC, and it can be made even anonymously. So there is no difficulty about the making of a complaint. The investigations that are conducted will take place largely in public. There are only a couple of rare cases where that will not be in public. And reports that come out at the far end will be able to include findings of corrupt conduct. Now, there's very little reason for complaint about the fact that law enforcement personnel will be dealt with under a strict and effective body. The oddity is that when one turns to the rest of the federal personnel, that is parliamentarians and public servants, the body becomes entirely different. The definition of corruption is limited by the fact that any form of corruption must involve a criminal offence. And frequently, corruption, as we see it, doesn't involve a criminal offence at all. And as you said before, if you were investigating the sports rorts, well, where was the criminal offence? You had the coalition simply seeking to use money to give it to various sporting bodies, all of whom would no doubt have been very enthusiastic about receiving it. There is the first point, a very restricted definition of corruption. Secondly, there is no ability of an individual whistleblower to complain directly to the commission. If someone happened to see a federal politician receiving a large bag of cash with all the implications of corruption that would flow from that, that witness could not go straight to the commission to report it. That person would have to go to one of the other bodies, like the federal police or the border force, and say to them, look, I've seen this, and try to get that body to report the matter to the CIC, which would involve there being a reasonable suspicion of some criminal offence involved. And even a person receiving a large bag of cash would not necessarily involve a criminal offence. It could be just a sizable political donation. That's the second thing. Thirdly, when you get to investigations, there would be absolutely no public investigation where a parliamentarian or senior public servant was concerned. They will all take place in private. And the next matter is that when you get to reports about these bodies, you recall that in a law enforcement investigation, there may be a finding of corrupt conduct. There are two relevant sections in the proposed exposure draft. One of them says, and the other is to like effect, that a report under this section must not include any opinion or finding that is critical, either expressly or impliedly of, or a recommendation about a parliamentarian. Now, if that body was investigating a complaint that a parliamentarian was seen receiving a very large handbag, including a lot of cash, you could not even report that fact, because inevitably there would be an implied criticism of the fact. It is the most ludicrous statement to find in an act about reports of investigations of parliamentarians, ministers, or senior public servants. And the only possible explanation can be that they will not allow public investigation or reports about their nefarious activities, and the assumptions that you can draw about their being very nervous that their activities will be exposed.
So is this salvageable, or is it really too hard to reform this draft? Does it really have to be torn up and you start again?
I think they should tear up half of the draft, that part dealing with parliamentarians and the public service. And if they then tried to make the remainder of the Act apply across the whole range of federal public servants and law enforcement officers, that would be a much better arrangement.
So what you're saying is that the part that applies to the law enforcement people should apply in all its provisions to the parliamentarians and the bureaucrats?
Yes, certainly. Now, the explanation that Mr. Porter gave when he announced his exposure draft was that there were two things. He said, firstly, there is much more corruption in the law enforcement area, and it's well hidden, which means we've got to have a much stronger body to do it. And secondly, we're not going to have people's reputations being trashed. I have seen no evidence of any kind to justify the assertion that there is more corruption in law enforcement than there is elsewhere. But even if there were, what on earth is the reason for applying a so much easier, a softer model, salving people's reputations? When you take the fact that people in law enforcement, up to the very most senior levels of the police, the border force, and any other places, in the tax office and the like, they can all be put before the whole of the banking industry was able to be put before public hearings from start to finish in the Hain inquiry, time and again in the Fitzgerald Commission in the 1980s. All of the Queensland government, right up to the Premier himself, went through public hearings. And the result was that a great deal of corruption was exposed to the extreme benefit of the whole Queensland community. Now, the hypocrisy that is involved in this process is doubled when you realise that there is, in fact, federal legislation in 2012 dealing with the establishment of parliamentary commissions to deal with judicial misbehaviour. Section 23 of that Act stipulates that in the first instance, investigations of judicial misbehaviour, which could be up to the High Court, must take place in public. So, in other words, everyone else can be dealt with in public, but not politicians. And what does that show you about the concern they have of their activities being exposed? And when you remember the hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars that this coalition has shown, it is prepared to spend on its to its electoral advantage rather than in the interests of the public.
Now, to be devil's advocate here, the government, the politicians would say, well, there's the danger which they perceive in some of these anti-corruption bodies of them being politically weaponized. Do you think protections need to be built in even to a much different body like you're advocating to stop that weaponization?
Plainly, a body with these powers must not be allowed to be weaponized by, obviously, the political party in power at the time. It must not. But it'd be much more difficult, I think, for it to be used by an opposition in that way, but I agree with you, or either. Now, in the first place, it's very important that you choose the right people as commissioner or deputy commissioners and other personnel, and it should be done in a bipartisan process. Next, the body should be under the control of the judicial system, which in this case would mean under the control of the federal court. Next, there should be an inspector, and next, there should be a parliamentary committee, which should have its activities under continual review. With those protections and the ability of a federal court to step in, as of course happened in the Carnine case, then I think that you are able to predict that the attempt of misuse of a body of this kind would be able to be prevented by alert action on behalf of the people who are chosen to run the body, and those various steps being taken to judicial control, the inspector, parliamentary committee and the like. And I would add, I think there should be an ability of someone damaged by findings of a body of this kind to appeal against an improper finding.
Now, just finally, the election is bearing down. There seems little chance that this legislation, even if introduced before the end of the year, is going to get through before the election. And anyway, you think it should be torn up and a fresh start made. Do you think that if the coalition is re-elected, it will in fact drop the whole idea of an integrity commission?
It is possible that if the coalition is re-elected, they might reintroduce their present model. They have said that the whole thing was, of course, under continual review. They would receive representations for people. I went to one of those hearings where we were invited to attend, and I went with Fiona McLeod and David Harper. We were three representatives of the Accountability Roundtable, and we appeared before Senator Amanda Stoker. And we said that we wanted to make submissions about the definition of corruption, about the division of the exposure draft's activities into two halves, and about public hearings. And Senator Stoker immediately said to us, none of those are on the table. It's a great negotiation process, obviously, that's taking place so far as the coalition is concerned. They hate the idea of a body that might investigate their activities, particularly when they are prepared to engage in matters like the sports rorts and the car park rorts. They intend to go on using large amounts of money that are at the disposal of the government in power.
Well, it's going to be a very interesting debate, I think, in the next few weeks. Stephen Charles, thank you very much for talking with the Conversations podcast today. That's all for now. Thank you to my producer, Ellen Duffy. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.